I'm Jeremy Hobson, host of The Hobcast and former host of Here and Now and Marketplace Morning Report. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. Before we start, I want to say I've been a longtime listener to this program from way back in the days when it was Matt Miller, Bob Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. It has been a great show for a long time. But Josh Barrow and his producer, Sarah Fay, definitely brought it to the next level, and they should be so proud of everything they accomplished here. It is an honor to be here as a guest host for a few weeks. Well, it is the first week of 2022, and this week, the United States is averaging more than 500,000 COVID-19 cases per day, probably far lower than the actual number because so many Americans are self-testing and those results are not reported. Hospitalizations are up about 50% in this country in the last 2 weeks, but so far, COVID deaths have not increased much in the Omicron surge. Hopefully, that is because the variant is less severe than previous ones. Still, the Biden administration is finalizing contracts for the 500,000,000 rapid tests they'll be sending out for free to Americans who want them. No word on when exactly they will be available, though. The president again called the pandemic one of the unvaccinated and said there's no excuse for anyone being unvaccinated at this point. Let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. I am your center. I'm joined by Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times on the left. Hi, Jamel.
Hello.
And Alice Stewart, Republican political consultant on the right. Alice, great to have you as well.
Hey, Jeremy. Great to be here.
Well, Jamel, let me start with you. What should the government and the Biden administration be doing right now, if anything, more than they're already doing, to deal with this massive Omicron surge?
It's clear that the Biden administration's intent was to try to project some sense of normalcy, but that's obviously out the window. And in my view, the approach the administration should have taken from the beginning was to act aggressively to stem the pandemic as much as possible. That means equipping Americans with the things they need, protective masks, tests. That means much more aggressively encouraging vaccination than I think the administration has actually been. And that means that in the event that there has to be extended quarantine periods, such as when you have a massive surge that is making people, lots of people very sick, and providing the resources so that people can't actually be home for the 10 days they need to be home. But in my view, the administration, in its drive to try to create a sense of normalcy, has more or less abandoned that and kind of left things up to, you might say, personal responsibility. And that's just not going to be an effective way of handling a pandemic and handling a surge, certainly.
Alice, what do you think? What should Biden be doing?
Clearly, more focus needs to be put on making sure that the tests get out to the stores and to the people. I was very encouraged by his recent meeting that he had with governors across the country and Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, the chairman of the National Governors Association, gave the Biden administration credit right off the bat for, first and foremost, depoliticizing the pandemic, which I think was really important. This is a health issue, not a political issue. And putting an emphasis on, as Biden said, if states need something, let us know. And putting a great emphasis on getting the tests out where they need to be. I commend President Biden for acknowledging that they could have been a little more ahead of the ball when it comes to the tests needed, the rapid tests, the home tests, and making sure that they took the necessary steps. And look, no one could have anticipated how the coronavirus was going to play out over the last 2 years. No one could have anticipated we would still be seeing 1 million new daily COVID cases a day. No one could have anticipated that. But the large reason why we're putting so much emphasis on President Biden is the fact he did campaign on, and I do believe in large part won, on saying that he would put COVID in the rearview mirror and saying that he would put an end to COVID. And he has acknowledged the buck stops with him. So it's important. And I think I'm satisfied with the fact they realize more needs to be done and putting an emphasis on testing and also vaccinations and encouraging people to get their boosters is where we need to go moving forward.
I agree with both of you. And I actually think I would go even further and say it's shameful that this far into the pandemic, there aren't adequate tests for people to get anywhere they want at any time. We've had, you know, 2 years of trying to figure out who has coronavirus, who doesn't have it. There should be tests available. And the fact that we're playing catch up right now, that the administration is playing catch up to get tests out, I think is pretty bad. On the issue of vaccinations, you know, he's been pushing to get people vaccinated. But we had an interesting situation this week in New York where the new mayor, Eric Adams, came in and I was watching some of his interviews. And he said, of course, you know, people should need to be vaccinated to do almost anything in New York City, but we're not going to shut the city down. And I feel like maybe if Biden had a simple message like that, get vaccinated, here are your tests, but we want to keep things moving along, it may be easier for people who are sick of the restrictions to put up with, you know, what Biden is asking to be done. One other thing I'll say is, you know, there's the Biden administration strategy on coronavirus. And then there are a lot of Republican governors, such as Ron DeSantis in Florida, who are basically saying, we don't want to do anything at this point to deal with it. And a lot of Floridians seem pretty happy with that. Alice, let me ask you about that. DeSantis wouldn't even say if he had been boosted, if he had gotten the booster shot recently. President Trump was booed when he said that he was boosted. What would incentivize the unvaccinated to actually get vaccinated and boosted at this point?
Clearly, actions speak louder than words. And I think a big ball was dropped when former President Trump did get the vaccine while he was president and didn't do so in a public fashion and acknowledged it after the fact. I think the more we can get leading Republicans and conservative voices to not only talk the talk, but walk the walk with regard to the need for vaccinations, that's extremely important. And look, I'm happy to hear that former President Trump has finally acknowledged to getting the booster and really stood up when he was booed about that, acknowledging, look, we need to do this. And even taking on a very supportive Candace Owens, who has been supportive of former President Trump for many years, really getting into a back and forth with her about the need for vaccines. Unfortunately, it was, I think, a little too late. Many Republicans have stigmatized vaccines and stigmatized using masks, and that has been unfortunate. And a lot of people, the cake is baked in that regard, and they're not going to change their mind. So the more we can get leading voices on the right to stress the need for vaccinations, the better. And clearly, Governor DeSantis in Florida, his focus and his priority right now is to get as many tests as he can possibly get out to the people of his state to make sure that people are aware of their current status. But it's a multi-legged stool with how we move forward and protect ourselves. It is tests, it's vaccines, it's masks, it's social distancing, it's all of the above is the best way we're going to put this in the rearview mirror.
Jamel, what do you think? What would incentivize people to get vaccinated so that we can finally put this in the rearview mirror, as Alice said?
That's a difficult question, I think, because it's clear that the status of being unvaccinated is not has long since gone beyond being a, you know, a cost benefit calculation for the people who've decided it's not worth it, and become something like a part of their identity, at least for some substantial portion. Right? It's tied up with partisanship. It's tied up with ideology. It's tied up with all these other things that you can't simply incentivize people to get rid of, or at least you can't incentivize with carrots. At this point, if the United States is ever going to achieve something like, you know, total vaccination against COVID, it's going to have to require sticks. And I think that's going to mean, or that has to mean, mandates essentially requiring the vaccine for any meaningful participation in public life, which is a thing that people don't like to hear. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the, you know, big problems with regards to the United States' pandemic response is that Americans are just resistant to the idea that this is actually something that requires a fully collective response. That at the end of the day, the only way to make this thing end is for there to be mandates and directives and the kinds of things that rub against, I think, our often very well, you know, our justifiable and often quite laudable desire for autonomy and individualism, but are end up being counterproductive against something that is essentially a social problem. It's an individual problem. And so it demands a social answer. And at this point, I think that social answer are just mandates for the vaccine for participation in public life.
Well, could the Biden administration go so far? Would this get past the Supreme Court for them to say, you cannot collect any government benefits of any kind, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, welfare of any kind, unless you're vaccinated?
I mean, I don't, I don't know the ins and outs of administrative law. So I don't know if that's a thing that is possible. My sense is that the Supreme Court would not be very happy about that. But in if we're just thinking blue sky, yeah, that's the kind of thing I think would be effective, right? Don't know how you would make this happen, but you can't collect the mortgage interest deduction unless you get vaccinated. Would you know, spur some people. Something more feasible, right, is you can't board an airplane for a domestic flight if you are not vaccinated. That would get people to get vaccinated.
It is interesting to be in an airport, and I was just in one the other day, and see how everybody is wearing masks in an airport, whereas if you go into a lot of other places where masks are required, not necessarily everyone is wearing a mask. But you're right. It could be that the airports would be one way to do that. One of the things that we've seen, and I wonder how much of this is about COVID, is that Biden's approval rating has been sinking lower and lower ever since the summer. I think the other day there was a poll that came out that said overall just 56% of voters disapprove of the job he's doing. That's a CNBC Change poll. And I want to bring in our special guest just to talk about that for a minute before we go to break. And that is Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report. Amy, welcome to you.
Well, hello. Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, it's great to have you. And I just want to ask you, as you hear this conversation about COVID-19 and President Biden, how important is this issue of all the issues going to be, you know, a matter of months from now when voters go to the polls in the midterms?
It's everything. I mean, we have known this since the very moment that President Biden was sworn into office. I think as Alice said, you know, he ran on a campaign of bringing an end to COVID, on making this his number one priority. And he said throughout the campaign and in his first days in office, look, we're never going to be able to get anywhere on anything else, getting the economy back on track, getting people feeling confident about, you know, pretty much the direction of every institution in this country until we get COVID under control. And I think the biggest problem for the president politically was that it looked in early summer like that indeed did happen. And you could see the corresponding rise in the following things in early summer. You saw a rise in consumer confidence. You saw a rise in the number of people who said, yeah, I feel pretty good about the COVID situation. Like, I think we're in a really good place. Mm-hmm. And Joe Biden's job approval ratings. When August hit, three things happened that I think really took a toll on his job approval ratings and continue to. The Delta surge is obviously the most prominent. The Afghanistan pullout, and then the rising costs that people were starting to feel at their gas tank, at the grocery store. All three of those things really took a real hit to the president's job approval rating, because they all three of them went at the central premise of his presidency, which is he was going to be the competent one. He was going to put smart people around him, not just these political cronies like Donald Trump did. He was going to be able to be boring, but effective. Mm-hmm. And now all of those things are being questioned. And until until people feel like this is under control and the economy's back on track, it's going to be very hard for the president to get much movement in his overall ratings.
Well, and he hasn't spent very much time connecting those economic issues, the rising prices, the supply chain crisis, to this historic pandemic that is the worst in 100 years that we're still dealing with, that is leading to exactly what you're talking about there. I will be back with Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, Jamelle Bouie of the New York Times, Alice Stewart of the Harvard Kennedy School of Politics in a moment to talk about January 6th. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Jeremy Hobson, your guest host, formerly of NPR's Here and Now and the Marketplace Morning Report. On the right is Alice Stewart. On the left is Jamelle Bouie. And we're joined by Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report. A year ago this week, the House and the Senate met to certify the presidential election that Joe Biden won with 306 electoral votes compared with Donald Trump's 232. Just before the certification was to begin, President Trump held a rally near the White House during which he told supporters that the election was stolen and that they should, quote, fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore, end quote. Within an hour of that speech, around 1:30 p.m., protesters at the U.S. Capitol had stormed barricades and made their way up the steps, later breaking windows to gain entry and forcing lawmakers to evacuate the chambers. President Trump didn't call on the rioters to leave the Capitol for hours until 4:17 p.m. Lawmakers finally came back in later in the night to certify the election results. As the country marked a year since the insurrection this week, President Biden said this.
We must be absolutely clear about what is true and what is a lie. And here's the truth. The former president of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. He's done so because he values power over principle, because he sees his own interest as more important than his country's interest, than America's interest, and because his bruised ego matters more to him than our democracy or our Constitution. He can't accept he lost.
President Trump, meanwhile, continues to say falsely that the real insurrection happened on November 3rd, the presidential election, and that January 6th was a day of protesting the fake election results. Alice Stewart, if you asked different people in different parts of this country what happened on that day, you would no doubt get different answers. So I want to ask you and then Jamelle, what happened on that day in your view?
Clearly, it was, without a doubt, a dark day in our history. The insurrection at the Capitol should have never happened. And while we hear loud voices of Donald Trump and his supporters, I can assure you there are rational Republicans across the country. I'd like to include myself in that category, who have believed from November on Election Day of 2020 until now that we had a free and fair election. Donald Trump lost. Joe Biden won. We should not have questioned the certification of the Electoral College votes. We should have had a peaceful transfer of power. And Joe Biden is the duly elected president, period. There are many who truly believe that. And they realize Donald Trump certainly did not want to lose. And his false claims of election fraud are just that, false. He's had more than 60 opportunities to fight this legal challenge in the courts, and he has lost. His failure to produce the Kraken is quite telling. And there are many Republicans who realize we need to put this in the past and look to the future, the next election coming up in November of this year. That's really important. And what I thought was single-handedly what President Biden did to former President Trump, in his speech on January 6th, on the anniversary of the insurrection of the Capitol, he assigned new pronouns to former President Trump, and those being lose, lost, and loser. And that's not going to sit well with the former president, but the facts are the facts. And Joe Biden is the president.
You know, it is interesting, though, Alice, you say that, you know, you and many other rational Republicans say what you say. You'd hear almost no members of Congress say what you just said. Jamel Bowie, what happened on that day in your view?
I see January 6th as two things primarily. The first, as we all witnessed, is an unprecedented breach of the United States Capitol, an attempt to subvert the counting of the Electoral College votes to prevent the election of Joe Biden under the deeply mistaken idea that this was even a thing that one could do. But it was an attempt to, a will to power in service of Donald Trump. The other thing, though, and I think what gets lost in thinking of January 6th as a singular moment is the extent to which all of this rests on a set of ideas and beliefs that are longstanding and have been in Republican Party politics. The idea that there are groups of Americans who do not have a legitimate claim to power, whose votes are de facto evidence of voter fraud, is something we saw all during the last decade. It's a mainstay. It's been a mainstay of conservative rhetoric for at least a decade, and there are scholars who will make the argument that it's been a mainstay of conservative rhetoric for even longer than that. The sense that Democrats holding power is in itself somehow illegitimate. It's something we saw in reaction to Obama's election in 2008. And I think it's been a recurring part of American politics since at least the 1990s. And the ways that our electoral institutions, like the Electoral College, like the malapportionment of the Senate, now, the way these things allow a relatively narrow faction of the public to win, you know, majority power in our institutions, I think also inculcates this idea that one group of Americans is more entitled to rule than another. And all of that comes to a head, I think, with January 6th, which you can understand. And a former colleague of mine, Asita Wanevu, wrote about this for the New York Times. You can understand January 6th as a sort of primal scream against the idea that Donald Trump could legitimately lose. That all of these ideas have live currency within the Republican Party, and a critical number of Republican voters and activists and lawmakers have come to the conclusion, based off of those ideas, that an election which Donald Trump lost or which they lose cannot possibly be a legitimate election. And that's why, you know, looking forward from January 6th, I tend to see this as more the beginning of something perhaps new, perhaps an evolution of something old, but more closer to the beginning of a story than the end or even the middle.
I think as terrible as that day was, the thing that has come out over the last year for me is that it was so much more organized than it seemed at the time. That President Trump was trying to overturn the election using every tool that he could find, whether it was a call to the Georgia Secretary of State asking him to find thousands of ballots, or that invitation to the Pennsylvania state lawmakers to come down to the White House, or in the case of what happened on January 6th, telling a mob to march down to the Capitol and fight like hell. The problem, I think, is that there are so many Americans that don't believe that at all. I was watching the coverage of the anniversary this week on Fox News and heard one of the anchors say almost immediately that most Americans have moved on, which is a true statement, whether we like it or not. And I want to go to Amy Walter. What did the polls say, Amy, about what people believe about January 6th and what they want to be done about it?
I think two things can be true at the same time, which is, one, majorities of Americans say the attack on the Capitol was terrible. It was a dark moment in history. The president, former president, bears responsibility for this. And two, it's not a defining issue for my vote in 2022. And I think to Jamel's point is a really important one. And I just writing about this right now and talking with a Democratic pollster yesterday who does survey work primarily with voters of color and younger voters, who made that exact same point, which is where Democrats are really struggling, at least the president and Democratic leaders, is by not linking the attack on January 6th to a broader conversation about race and white supremacy. And his argument is that focusing so much on this was about trying to steal the vote, this is about trying to overturn an election, that misses the argument that really connects with the same people who took to the streets in 2020 after the killing of George Floyd, who are motivated not by this concept, this sort of this construct about, oh, Trump is bad because he's trying to steal an election, but the broader sense that if we don't talk about, if Democrats can't even talk about what this really is, we're not getting very far. And so ultimately what you have then is the Republicans who are going to stay on their side. The president didn't do anything wrong. This is an exaggeration. You have swing voters saying, yeah, I don't like what happened, but it's just not a top priority for me. Mm-hmm. And Democratic voters saying, absolutely, this was an insurrection. Absolutely, democracy is at stake. And yet those voters who Democrats really need to turn out to vote, younger voters, voters of color, are saying Democrats are missing the boat because they're not talking about what at its core this insurrection was really about.
Should they be doing that, Jamel?
I think so. I think, and you saw some of this with President Biden's January 6th speech, really, you know, to borrow a phrase, waving the bloody shirt about January 6th and tying it to Donald Trump. And I think that should have been a rhetorical strategy that the party should have used all along. I strongly believe that voters do not pick up on something. They don't just absorb things from the ether. You actually have to consistently slam the point and make the argument, and sort of activate voters to think of this as something salient to their political decision-making. And I think there's a way to tie January 6th into the sort of a broader political message. The one I would prefer is to point out that, you know, the people interested in overturning American democracy aren't doing it because for fun and games, or doing it for a particular purpose. And more often than that, that is an attempt to establish some sort of like dominance or hierarchy, typically for those who hold more power and more wealth than the rest of us. I think that might be an appealing message, at least to some subset of voters. And hammering on that is, I think, more fruitful than simply hoping that voters pick up that this was a bad thing, because it's just how things work.
We're going to get to voting rights legislation in just a little bit, but let's talk about what's happening right now and holding people accountable for January 6th and the inquiry that is going on. One of the things that I found to be so frustrating as I was watching January 6th unfold a year ago is, where are the police? Why are they just letting these people inside the building? Why did they let them go home peacefully at the end? It was like red light camera justice. You drive through the red light camera and then weeks later they send you a ticket. They're now trying to, you know, find all of these people who were in the Capitol. And Merrick Garland said this week that they've arrested 750 or charged 750 people. I'm sure there were a lot more than that in the Capitol that day. But what is taking the Democrats and Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, the only two Republicans on that committee, so long to get to the bottom of this? They really only have until the midterms, where they probably will, you know, the Democrats will lose control of the House and this investigation will go away. They need to move with more urgency, it seems. Alice, Republicans refuse to participate in this inquiry. What do you think of it so far? What do you think of what's going on with it right now?
I think the slow nature of this is simply based on the fact that there's such a tremendous volume of information and evidence to be gleaned from that day. And they are getting a great deal of resistance from those that are subject to subpoenas. You know, we've seen certainly Mark Meadows, Steve Bannon, and many others who refuse to honor their subpoena. And that is causing a big slow in the process of gathering data. I'm encouraged by others that have come forth. We know Stephanie Grisham, who was very close to the goings-on in the White House, has come forth, and other leading officials. We know that there have been several hundred subpoenas issued for information. And look, the wheels of justice, and in this case, this committee, are slow, but it's more important to get it right than to get it right now. And I would much rather them take their time and make sure that the right people are held accountable for their wrongdoings, so that there's not an appeal and further questions down the road. But at the same time, Democrats are going slow and meticulous, potentially at their own peril.
Right.
If this continues to go past November of this year and Republicans are in control in the House, this all becomes, in my view, a moot point and will not continue.
Well, and I could also see, you know, if President Trump wins election again in 2024, he could very well pardon all of the insurrectionists who have been charged and you know, pleaded guilty or found guilty. Jamel, what do you think of the inquiry?
I think the inquiry is a good thing. I think that it is important that the public has as much information about what happened and how it happened as possible. My preference would just be for more spectacle. This is, I think, where I'm a little old-fashioned in how I think about how politics should be conducted. I think politics is much more about storytelling and creating compelling links for the public and creating villains for the public than it is anything else. Mm-hmm. And so for me, there's obviously this good government element to the January 6th inquiry. For as much as there are these, we have these political leaders who are always saying, well, I don't want to politicize this. This is too important to be politicized. I actually think this should be politicized and it should be used as fuel for an actual political effort to hold the lawmakers who were in league or in tandem with the January 6th rioters, hold them responsible. If barring Donald Trump from running for office again is kind of out of the picture at this point, then the least that we can do is actually build a compelling political argument for why this guy should be kept as far away from power as possible and not sort of rely on people's memories, which, as I said earlier, you can't really rely on them. You have to handhold people to the conclusion you want them to take. And that means spectacle, that means argument, that means a certain amount of, you know, flamboyance in your politics that I think is missing from all of this.
Amy Walter, do you expect that to happen, that there'll be some big fireworks days on Capitol Hill that are broadcast all over the TV networks? And do you think that the Democrats are going to speed up this inquiry so that they can get it wrapped up before the election?
Well, the latest I saw was the expectation that the inquiry will be completed by November, which doesn't suggest that it's going very quickly. I mean, finishing it right at the time of the midterms is different from finishing it a few months ahead of the midterms. Do I suspect that it's going to get some attention? Absolutely. The cable shows love nothing more than, you know, some fiery action on the Capitol. And quite frankly, it's the only thing that's going to be happening on Capitol Hill between now and the midterms. So that gives them some good content. As for whether it's going to move voters, I'm very, very doubtful. Even most of the stuff that we're hearing that has been coming out has been about things that people have either already known or already suspected, right? That the president was being lobbied extensively, even by his own family, to call off the mob, that he sat and watched for, you know, 2 hours before he took any action, that you had, you know, many folks involved in different parts of the administration working on overturning this election. So I don't know that there's much that is going to change anybody's mind. I think the bigger challenge, again, the biggest challenge right now in a midterm, this is very different though than if Donald Trump tries to run again in 2024. So I want to be really clear. I think in 2024, Trump's actions that he took on January 6th are a factor and are going to be a factor to a lot of voters, even voters who supported Donald Trump in the 2020 election. I do think, though, in a midterm election where voters are looking at, okay, what's happening in my life? What's the grade that I give this administration for how things are going in my life? It's a referendum on the person who's in office now, not the person who is no longer in office. And so it's going to be about Joe Biden and how his administration is doing on handling these sort of core economic issues and COVID.
I've been talking with Amy Walter, Jamelle Bouie, and Alice Stewart. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
American democracy has been challenged like never before, and Left, Right, and Center is committed to civilized yet provocative confrontations over politics, policy, and pop culture. Get it in your feed each week by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jeremy Hobson. On the right is Republican political consultant Alice Stewart. On the left is Jamelle Bouie of The New York Times. And we're joined by special guest Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report. One of the things that Democrats have said is needed, the main thing to safeguard our democracy from things like what happened a year ago, is real action on voting rights in Congress. Using President Trump's lie that the election was stolen as their reasoning, Republican state legislators in 19 states have passed bills to restrict voting access. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, these laws do things like limit early voting, mail-in voting, expand voter purges, impose stricter signature requirements for mail-in ballots, and impose criminal penalties for things like handing out water or snacks to voters who are waiting in line. Democrats have said the only way to combat this is to pass a federal voting rights law, but the only way for them to do that is to either get 10 Republican senators to vote with them or to eliminate the filibuster, which appears unlikely. Amy Walter, what are the chances anything gets passed on voting rights?
Slim to none. The only chance I think we could see something might involve reforming something known as the Electoral Act of 1887. This is something that Republicans are now floating, including Mitch McConnell. This is the very arcane law that directs what Congress can, theoretically, directs what Congress can and cannot do when it comes to the Electoral College votes that are coming in from the states. And it's has a very big loophole that obviously then President Trump tried to encourage Mike Pence to follow by saying he could just invalidate the votes coming in from certain states. The argument Republicans are making is, look, how do we prevent another January 6th? Close that loophole. Make it really clear. Congress can't do that. The vice president can't do it. We're done. Now, Democrats make the point, okay, well, that's not exactly solving the problem, because the problem really is what's happening at the states. If state legislators decide to send a different state of electors than the ones that, say, were certified, well, now we're into a real crisis that Congress can't solve. And so you can't solve any of these problems unless you solve voting rights at the state level. But ultimately, look, there is not a 60-seat majority for Democrats. They need to have that number in order to pass this legislation, because no Republicans are coming on board, or one Republican is coming on board for one piece of legislation. And the filibuster is in place and is likely to continue to be in place.
Alice Stewart, does it disturb you what the Republican state legislators are doing when it comes to restricting voting access?
My view on this is that elections are run at the state level, and states know how to best run their own elections. And I have served as Deputy Secretary of State in Arkansas, We oversaw the election process in a contentious redistricting year. And I have the full faith and confidence in states running their own elections. There are plenty of checks and balances from the ballot box to the certification at the U.S. Capitol that makes sure that our elections are free and fair. And I have, as I said, states should run their elections how they see fit. That being said, I think Amy is a little bit more optimistic about voting laws being changed by saying slim to none. My view is none to absolutely zero, because it's just not going to happen. We don't need to federalize our elections. We don't need to run them from the national level. As I said, they need to be done at the state level. And the idea of changing the filibuster for this is a tremendous mistake. The filibuster is an important tool for Senate to seek bipartisanship. And by doing away with that for this one piece of legislation would set a bad precedent. When you're the party in power and you change the filibuster for your own gains, you're going to regret that when you're no longer the party in power. So I see a lot of pushback on that attempt to do so, and for good reason. It should not happen.
I have to say, I disagree on the filibuster. The 60-vote threshold is not in the Constitution. They've already gotten rid of it for judicial nominees. That was the Democrats who did that. The Republicans got rid of it for Supreme Court nominees. You know, we've all thought a lot about this. In a way, I would rather have a situation where Washington can actually just do what they want to do and answer to the voters than not be able to do almost anything at all, which is what it seems like the situation is now. Jamel, you know, voters of color have the most to lose here, as we've talked about, if voting access is restricted, as it has been in so many states. What should Biden do? What should the Democrats do? Or what happens if there's nothing on voting rights?
So I'll answer that last question first. I think if there's nothing, if nothing happens on voting rights, then I think we'll continue to see, or just election reform in general, I think we'll continue to go along the path that we have. When the Supreme Court struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, and then when it sort of took an axe to Section 2, it essentially opened up states to pursue more or less whatever kind of voting restrictions they desired, barring they don't, you know, meet some very minimal bars. And so that's what I expect to continue to happen, along with the extreme partisan gerrymandering, which on a, you know, on the federal level, this has an effect, but I think the effect is much more profound on the state legislative level, where you have states like Wisconsin and North Carolina and Pennsylvania and Michigan, where it would take once in a century majorities of Democratic voters to win power, win majorities in the state legislature. Meaning, so in Wisconsin, for example, a Democratic Party that won 55% of the statewide vote would probably not win 50% of the seats in the legislature. And that level of partisan gerrymandering, I think, makes a mockery of the idea that any of these states are republics, much less democracies, if we want to pretend like there's a real distinction between those terms. And so that's my fear is that on the path that the United States is on, especially on the state level, there will be large swaths of voters who effectively will not have any meaningful way to elect political representation for themselves, or at least have any meaningful say in how the states are governed. Where one stands on this often falls along partisan lines. And the Republican Party, generally speaking, is comprised of a lot of people who seem to sincerely believe that the only way they can win is by restricting their opponents or prospective proponents. I will say, I don't think this is true. I think this is sort of a delusion people have convinced themselves of, but people, you know, when people believe something, they believe something. Setting aside the idea that there's something sort of sacred about the filibuster, which as you said, that it's not in the Constitution, it's sort of a weird parliamentary mistake. It's never really been used to enhance debate. It's most often been used, you know, in the early 20th century to kill anti-lynching legislation, in the mid 20th century to kill civil rights legislation. It has a pretty sordid history. I'll say, I don't think it actually encourages bipartisanship either. And I think that becomes clear just when you think about what it actually does. What the filibuster does in the modern Senate is that for any legislation that isn't really related to the budget or anything that isn't related to, you know, nominations, you need 60 votes to pass something, which means that if you work diligently to assemble a 55-vote coalition of Republicans and Democrats, it means no, it doesn't mean anything. 55 votes matters as much as 59 votes as 51 votes, mm-hmm. which to my mind is a disincentive away from bipartisanship, right? I think returning to simple majorities for legislation, which is how the Senate was designed in the first place, would be more conducive to the kinds of cooperation and horse trading and bipartisanship that people say they want versus supermajorities. And I think at the very least, we can say that supermajorities have not actually had the effect that defenders say it has had. And so, you know, might as well try the other thing, which is sort of the thing that 99% of legislatures in the world run on, which is simple majorities for legislation.
Well, we have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Alice Stewart, it's your soapbox.
Okay, you asked for it. You're going to get it. My rant is about the troubling case of spoiled athlete syndrome. We have self-entitled, self-centered, selfie-taking, highly paid athletes who've forgotten about the love of the game. Their rules apply to thee, but not to me mentality is insulting. I'm talking specifically about 20-time Grand Slam tennis champ Novak Djokovic. He thought he had a special waiver to skirt the rules with COVID to play the Australian Open. Not so much. Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers claimed he was vaccinated and later find out he's not. He's getting a lot of heat. And Tampa Bay Bucks wide receiver Antonio Brown walked away from his team in dramatic fashion, saying he was forced to play while injured. I just think the spoiled athlete syndrome is at an all-time high, and a healthy dose of humility and respect is in order to remind people about the collective achievement of a team and the love of sports.
Spoiled athletes, there's her rant. Jamel Bowie, what about you?
So I read a lot of political journalism and a lot of political analysis. And one of my big pet peeves and something I'm growing increasingly frustrated by is how so many folks seem to rely on a set of basically anecdotes. We saw this a couple of days ago. You know, Biden should fire the Chicago teachers like Reagan did the airport traffic controllers. And it's this reliance on these anecdotes sort of completely divorced from any context and completely divorced from any of like the larger material or social dynamics and realities happening around those events. And it just is, it's sort of like an airport bookstore style of analysis that I find very frustrating. And I don't like it. I wish it would stop.
Okay. Amy Walter, what about you?
Jeremy, I could host an entire show on this issue, which comes back to the issue of community, right? We are seeing a breakdown in community when it comes to everything from people attacking flight attendants, getting in fights with waiters and waitresses over masks, violence over some of these issues I find appalling. It's been sitting here too, in my view, and everything that is wrong with shared biking trail resources, you know, those, whether it's you have a rails to trails or a bike, pedestrian thing that's supposed to bring the community together. Instead, I find that often these things tend to pull us apart, in part because people aren't effectively behaving as a community. You should not be walking four abreast just because you can. Okay. Just don't do it. If your dog doesn't like people, don't bring them where there are people. Right. You're not in the Tour de France. You're on a bike path in Washington. Stop. Okay?
You know, pickleball courts have torn Provincetown, Massachusetts apart, I will tell you right now. I want to just say for my rant, which is not really a rant, that I am just so excited to be hosting this show in Santa Monica at KCRW right now, because I have listened to Left, Right, and Center for so long when I was a producer at NPR's Day to Day back in 2005, which was based in LA. I used to listen when I hosted the Marketplace Morning Report from LA. My first show was at 5:50 in the morning, 2:50 Pacific, which meant I had to be at the office at 1 in the morning, which means I woke up at 12:15 listening to KCRW DJs like Travis Holcomb and Anthony Valadez and Aaron Bird to get my day started. And then when I hosted Here and Now, I started a weekly segment with KCRW DJs called the DJ Sessions to bring some of the amazing music that KCRW discovers to NPR listeners across the country. By the way, Travis Holcomb DJed my wedding and was incredible. But the thing I love about this, and I will wrap with this, is that good journalism is very important. We all agree on that. But there's more to life than news. And I think KCRW does the mix so very well. So it's really great to be here. And that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to Jamel Bowie, Alice Stewart, and Amy Walter. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. The show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.